Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the Dallas Cowboys become the team to either love or hate in America, even if not always the team to beat? And what has the organization meant to the city it was named for? From the earliest days of the Cowboys' existence, back when they actually played home games in Dallas, they have been a source of deep pride for the city and occasionally a source of some embarrassment. And as Joe Nick Potosky tells us in his new book, the struggles and triumphs of the city have often been reflected in the team. The book is called The Dallas Cowboys, The Outrageous History of the Biggest, Loudest, Most Hated, Best Loved Football Team in America. Joe Nick, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
You know, it's funny. I thought about your title and I recently heard that when people are trying to get books to be Googleable, they will put in certain terms into the sort of semicolon area of the title. And I thought, anybody who writes Hate Dallas Cowboys will now find the book. Anybody who writes Love Dallas Cowboys will now find the book.
I was in the Metro Diner last Monday and with Angus Wynn, whose uncle was one of the founding owners of the team, and he was showing off the book to the waitresses. Three of them got real excited. And then one said, well, what if I don't like the Dallas Cowboys? And she had a real frown on her face. And I pointed out the most hated in the title. I said, this book's for you, too. This book is really for people that don't even like football. I mean, I hope I satisfy those hardcore fans that think they know it all. I'm going to teach them something. But the bigger story is it's what does all this mean? And why are we so nuts about football here in Dallas, and why has this team resonated around the world? These are all questions that I was asking myself, and that's why I did this. It's not to tell the story. We know what the team did and has done on the field, and we're talking about a very average football team since 1997. 122 wins, 122 losses. But why are they the most popular team in the NFL? Why are they the most valuable franchise in American sports today? I think it really is all about place, and it's this place makes all the difference in the world.
I think what's fascinating about this story is it forces you to ask these questions about whether or not the image of the city as well as the team is a sort of manufactured product, or whether the product that we've manufactured has played into how we feel about ourselves and how the rest of the world sees us and who's in control of that image.
These are good questions, and I think a lot of this book, and there's the football team, then there's the organization, which is exceptional and really has been innovative since the very beginning and continues to be innovative. I think that's why they're part of this conversation. But there's a lot on media, and there's a lot about marketing, and I really think that's one of the driving forces why we talk about this today is there were some brilliant marketing people within the organization and within Dallas. And I think in 1960, you look at Dallas, Texas, it could be compared, confused for place mid-sized, midwestern, southwestern cities, Kansas City, St. Louis, bigger than Oklahoma City, but just barely. And over this period of time, Dallas has become a very globally – it's a global brand, and it's known the world over. And I think at the root of all this – are the Cowboys. You had some brilliant people writing about them, broadcasting about them, and certainly marketing them. And the rise of Dallas as a market center in the United States, 1960, that did not exist. And when in the 60s and 70s, the rise of the market center, the rise of great commercial developers like Trammell Crow and his family and related corporations – all that, this city started to boom. And I make the argument that certainly with the DFW airport and three other factors all tied to the Cowboys, one is the Dallas Cowboys Football Club, the Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders, and the TV show Dallas. David Jacobs had never seen and never been to Dallas, the creator of the TV series.
Which is apparent to any of us who live here.
Well, of course. But all he knew were two things, the Dallas Cowboys and the Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders. Mm-hmm. He was actually going to cite it in Houston originally. And how different that would have been. But all these things conspired, and I think certainly DFW was a very important piece in this. It made Dallas, all these factors made Dallas the first glamorous city between either coast since Chicago in the early 20th century. And a lot of it was glitter marketing, a TV show, and this logo, which anyone could claim this logo of a blue star with a white outline, but there's some kind of brilliance in that with a sporting logo to be so simple and yet so universal. And you travel outside this country and you see this on the back of a pickup truck or someone wearing gear with it. It doesn't have to say Cowboys or Dallas on it. You know exactly what it means. So it telegraphs a whole lot about who we are, whether it's rightly or wrongly interpreted. But people have plenty of cues to understand this place called Dallas or think they know it. And I just think it's this relationship between the football team and the city is back and forth. The Cowboys wouldn't have been the Cowboys without this city and without the leadership it had and the growth it experienced during the evolution of the franchise. And similarly, I don't think Dallas would have the identity that it does as a city without that football team. Let's start with 1960. There were two teams in Dallas.
This is the greatest part of the story, and the fact that there had actually been a team in 52. Excuse me for interrupting.
Very few people pay attention to that little factoid. In 1952, there was an NFL franchise called the Dallas Texans that played at the Cotton Bowl. And because really, I think, one, the pro sport, the NFL didn't much matter. It was a northeastern sport with two franchises on the West Coast. It did not resonate here. They didn't last the whole season before they folded.
Like worst team ever. Right?
Worst team ever. They lost every game. And I loved it that the ownership group was headed by Giles Miller, who is the grandfather of Rhett Miller, the noted musician of Dallas.
Old 97s.
But you would have thought it would have worked because what I was trying to set up is how football nuts Texas was at that time. But Texas was so football nuts that the pro sport was kind of like diminished compared to the Southwest Conference football, SMU Mustangs, and high school football, which, you know, certainly during October in the state fair was packing out the stadium. I mean, coming close to packing out the stadium. But high school and college sports were too big, and Texas, I guess, was too regional at that time. I loved it that the very first touchdown that those 52 Dallas Texans scored was a halfback pass from George Tolliver to a receiver named Buddy Young. Young and Tolliver were the only black players on the team, and it was really segregated in 1952. Buddy Young was a track star. They called him the Bullet. So Bullet Bob Hayes had nothing new on Buddy Young. But this halfback pass scored the first points for the Texans, and one of the few times they were ahead of any team that season. And the only reason they got the ball is they had received the kickoff, run three plays, and then punted to the New York Giants. And the New York Giants punt receiver, Tom Landry, fumbled the ball. And the Texans recovered and scored these first points. So I just like the idea that this was not an easy sell. You'd think, oh, Texas pro football, no problem. But what it really speaks to is how young and tender the National Football League was in 1960. And again, it informs the growth of the NFL into what it is today. And it ain't just a sports league. It's the biggest entertainment in America. It parallels the growth of the Dallas Cowboys. Their story is the NFL's story.
So what happened? Lamar Hunt went to the NFL and said, I want an expansion. I want to put an expansion franchise in Dallas in 1960. Yeah. Or I guess this was 59 that he talked
about. Yeah, well, actually, Lamar Hunt had made several runs to Burt Bell, the commissioner of the NFL. And every time he asked about expansion, he would say, oh, no, the head of the expansion committee, George Halas, the owner, coach of the Chicago Bears, said no expansion. Go buy a team from someone. And Lamar had tried this. Lamar was a third-string receiver at SMU. Not very good, but he was a total sports nut. And Burt Bell said, no, I'm not going to do it. And finally, Lamar noticed that he wasn't the only one on the block the only guy with the means, the wherewithal to buy a team, who wanted a team and wasn't able to get a team. So through several acquaintances, he proposed to Burt Bell, well, how about if we start up another league to complement your league, the American Football League? And he went hat in hand to Burt Bell, and Burt Bell said, may I reveal this to the nation? And he did during a congressional hearing just as a means to make sure. I mean, they were getting – NFL was getting harassed for antitrust. So this was a way of saying, well, I'm supportive of this brand-new league, this young man – Lamar Hunt's going to start up, and he's going to have a franchise in Dallas. And the first thing that Bell and Halas did was decide, we got to crush this guy. And that's when another guy from Dallas who had been seeking a team since 1952, he tried to buy these Texans that were leaving town, Clint Murchison Jr., was suddenly given all the signals that he needed. We're going to get you an expansion franchise, and we're going to get you what we're going to fast track it so you can start it in 1960. So there will be not one but two teams in Dallas. And Lamar Hunt was well intentioned and honest and upfront. And basically, the Sharks saw that opportunity and, you know, screw you, we're going to crush you. And there was actually a point when they're discussing this is news in Dallas. Of course, the bigger sports news in Dallas at the time is, would Dallas-Fort Worth get a Major League Baseball franchise? That's what everybody was pining for back then.
Because that was the big sport.
That was the national pastime. Mm-hmm. And Houston had gotten was going to be awarded a franchise for Major League Baseball, the National League, and they were going to start up in 62. So the talk was, are we going to get one here? And that was the bigger news. So this was almost secondary news that these two gentlemen of incredible means –
two sons of oil barons.
And listen, this is where we got to measure it. This is not just any football team. And you start in 1960. We had not one, but two sons of two of the richest men on earth, two of the big four of Texas Oil, H.L. Hunt and Clint Murchison Sr. They had kids that had these football Jones so bad that they, and the wherewithal, they were going to start professional teams. And in 1960, the idea of owning any kind of professional sports franchise, this was a rich man's toy. Mm-hmm. This was not a business. This was an indulgence. This is something you liked doing because you were a sporting type. And the fact that there were two of them that started teams and one of them that started a whole league, this really made all the difference in the world. And we got to put this in perspective that the current owner, Jerry Jones, bought the team in 1989. And he was a man of some wealth through wildcatting, a really good oil and gas man, very effective. But Clint Murchison was far richer. And by entering the NFL as an expansion team owner, he was immediately the richest owner in the league. He had that kind of wealth. But he had a completely different style than Jerry Jones in that Clint's deal. And actually, it was Clint and his brother John, who was completely invisible. He was busy with the Dallas Museum of Art and endowing other great institutions. He was not that interested in football like his brother was. But they had all the money in the world, and they could do whatever they wanted. And what they did, what Clint did, is hire smart people and get out of the way.
We will hear about that in just a moment from author Joe Nick Petoskey. His new book is called The Dallas Cowboys, The Outrageous History of the Biggest, Loudest, Most Hated, Best Loved Football Team in America. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is author Joe Nick Petoskey. His new book is The Dallas Cowboys, The Outrageous History of the Biggest, Loudest, Most Hated, Best Loved Football Team in America. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address think@kera.org. Joe Nick, we have so much ground to cover here, but get us here. How did we end up with the Dallas Cowboys remaining in Dallas as opposed to the Dallas Texans?
Well, it was a battle for attendance in the hearts and minds of Dallas. And mine is not the only book to cover that period. John Eisenberg has a wonderful book, The 10-Gallon War, which is about this period of time. It's both owners had all the wherewithal in the world. But what they had to do is win fans' hearts and minds. And that Cotton Bowl during that period of time was never, ever filled. I think the biggest attendance was before the first season, the Texans played the startup Houston Oilers in an exhibition game and drew 50,000 in a 75,000 seat facility. But
coming up from Houston,
yeah,
essentially.
Well, there was just no interest. I mean, it was giveaways and really great. I mean, that bags of Frito corn chips had free tickets. The Texans did this big balloon, helium balloon thing where they attach tickets. And the old joke is someone left two Cowboys tickets on a windshield or inside a car on the windshield, and someone broke the windshield and left two more. No one cared. And it was really hard. And the odd thing is the one after the 1962 season, the Texans were good enough that they got in the AFL championship and won it in a great overtime game in Houston against the Oilers. And you thought, well, now they've won. But Lamar saw the writing on the wall, and you know, it was who's going to bleed to death first in the pocketbook. And Lamar said, no, he got a sweetheart deal to go to Kansas City. I was originally, that period of time, I was 8 years old when this started, and I was an avid, voracious reader of sports pages. And I remember, I mean, I was into the Texans. I wasn't into the Cowboys so much. I liked Don Meredith, and I remembered him from SMU. And I really liked Don Perkins, and I did seek him out and interview him for this book, the first star running back for the Cowboys. But the guy, my guy was Abner Haynes of the Dallas Texans, and he was just a flamboyant, fast, exciting running back. Not unlike Jim Brown, and he had all these local ties. He went to Dallas Lincoln, and then he broke the color line at North Texas State Teachers College, UNT now, and then he came to the Texans. And early on, they called the Texans the color league. They had more black athletes. They also broadcast in living color, while the NFL was still in black and white, and still every team did their own TV deal in the NFL. The AFL did the first league-wide contract. But it was a matter of this market was way too small for two teams. Even today, I mean, no matter how rabid the fan base is, that was not going to work. And the startup league gave in to the go team of the senior pros. That was one of the marketing logos for the Cowboys. I mean, think back to that. I mean, you're going to go buy tickets to go watch the go team of the senior pros? Come on. I mean, it was a tough sell. And the worst thing is the NFL, the teams were so – I mean, the Cowboys were so bad. They were an expansion franchise. They got their butts kicked every week except for tying New York in New York, the Giants, at the end of the season. And it was at least the AFL team won. They were so bad that Tex Schramm, the general manager of the Cowboys, decided to dress his team in visiting white uniforms. So if nothing else, fans could see real NFL teams in their home uniforms. Never mind the home team's going to get clobbered. But by doing that, he set a whole fashion – he made a fashion statement for the NFL. And there's a reason why the Cowboys still have the coolest-looking uniforms, and that's because they wore whites at home and not their colored blues.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Dell in Dallas. Hi, Dell.
Hi.
Hi, Dell.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah, I just wanted to call in and say that I designed the Cowboys logo, the current logo.
Dell Hermanovsky.
Right.
I've got your ex-wife is in this book talking about what you and she did as far as styling.
Exactly. We were designing the offices and ticket office for the Cowboys when they were on Central Expressway. And, you know, we were doing a lot of work for SRAM and all the guys up there. And I said to him one day, I said, you know, your logo doesn't look so good, Tex, because they, you know, as a bumper sticker, it was just a it was a guy on a horse with a helmet on, and it was kind of corny,
very corny, cartoony.
Cartoony. From 10 feet away, I said, you know, it kind of looks like bird poop on your bumper. So he said, well, can you come up with something that's better? And you know, I came up with the profile of the helmet and just the word Cowboys under it. It was printed originally on silver Mylar. And it became an instant success. I mean, they were giving them out every time you bought gas at any gas station. You got a Cowboy sticker, and you know, people plastered them everywhere for quite a few years. Unfortunately, I didn't make any money on it because I kind of gave it away to them. You know, I just, as I said, we were designing their offices and ticket office, so there you go.
And the office, actually, the design was such. It set a standard for the NFL and all the other franchises.
Exactly. The profile of the helmet set the standard for logos for the NFL, pretty much.
Well, this is kind of a point I'm trying to make, and it wasn't just marketing people, but artistic people, graphic illustrators. And what the Hermanovskys did was, if you look at it in the context of how sports a sports franchise looked at itself or sold itself to the public, it was cartoony, rinky-dinky, and they took it to a whole nother level. So it's the style. That's why, although he never donned a uniform as far as I'm concerned, and all I found is he did write an editorial about Barry Switzer. That's why Stanley Marcus is all over this book, because Neiman Marcus is, I think, where all the fashion sense and style sense of Dallas really originally emanates from. And Joellen Walton, who later became Jody Gent, married to Pete Gent, she grew up in Fort Worth, and I was kind of comparing notes about, you know, as a Fort Worther looks at Dallas. And I said, well, what did you think when you were growing up? She said, I love Dallas because my mama would take me to the weekly fashion shows at Neiman's, and I thought this was the greatest place in the world. Hmm. And it really is. It speaks to more. We're not talking just about a football team. But I got to say, Tex SRAM, the P.T. Barnum, the first general manager of the Cowboys, he was very attuned to style, look, and all these things. And plus, unlike anyone else in the National Football League, he'd come from CBS Sports.
So he knew that football was a TV sport.
Well, he saw its future as a TV sport when no one did. In fact, after he was hired in late 59, he had one last gig for CBS Sports, and that was, he televised, and he pushed for this. He did the first televised Olympics, which was the Winter Olympics from Squaw Valley, California. And the brass at CBS was not into this, but Tex believed in it so much. He was helping lay cable along the mountain slopes for this. And it's also through that, afterwards, he was offered gigs to run NBC Sports, to take over CBS Sports, but he already said, no, I've assumed this job. I'm going to be general manager of this expansion football franchise in Dallas. But his vision was certainly applied to this team, and just like Dale Hermanovsky said, I mean, Tex sought out the best and brightest, and like, let's not do this rinky-dink. Let's be first class. Let's be forward-thinking.
So we're halfway through the hour. We should probably talk a bit about the changing of the guard here. So Tex SRAM hung on through the Murchison years. He was there through the Bum Bright years.
Yep.
Very briefly in the Jerry Jones administration.
Very, very briefly. No, there's actually, this breaks down into two regimes. And the first regime was Clint Murchison as owner. The delegator steps out, gets out of the way. General manager Tex SRAM, who eventually became the team president. The coach, Tom Landry. A genius of a coach, and so far ahead of his peers in 1960 that what he did during the 60s and laying down the blueprint for the 70s really speaks to the modern NFL as far as how play is conducted on the field. I mean,
what was so different?
He was very, very complex, and he was counterintuitive, and that football is generally you go chase the guy with the ball and knock him down. Landry was all about protecting your zone and your position and being where you're supposed to be. You execute this plan, everything's going to go right. Even though your mind tells you, no, go after the guy with the ball. No, you guard your territory. And it really changed thinking. And just things like when the offensive line lined up, he had his linemen stand up and reset. And no one had done this before, and it confused other teams. And it also blocked the defense from seeing what the offensive background was lined up doing. So that's the first regime. And then you got to add Gil Brandt, the baby photographer who basically articulated modern professional football scouting. He was the head of scouting and player personnel. That was the first regime. That lasted all the way through when Clint basically started going broke and had to sell the team. In the early 80s, it was bought by Bum Bright, who is a caretaker. And for caretaking the team, he doubled his money while the rest of his fortune crashed in the SNL scandal. And that opened the door in 1989 for the second regime, which was owner and general manager Jerry Jones and his coach Jimmy Johnson. And they cleared the decks, upset the apple cart, unceremoniously fired Landry, and in a move that, yes, it lacks social grace. And then again, some people say it had to be done. But there are those fans from that first regime that remember will never forgive Jerry Jones for that act, no matter how many Super Bowls he's won.
Well, I'll talk about this because it almost went down like a coup is the wrong word, but this took a lot of people by surprise.
You know, I look at it that Dallas is not a place that has embraced its traditions much. It's always, let's look forward, and if something's in the way, knock it down, build on top of it, build it newer, shinier, and better. And that really has been the Dallas way of business, I think. And you know, it's a business-first, can-do mindset. And yet, here was one tradition that even if Landry was not doing very well, there was a 7-year period when the team was not in the playoffs. They weren't contenders. And the natives were restless. But what they realized is when this change happened is our tradition is being taken away. Landry was the only coach the Cowboys ever had. Schramm was the only general manager they ever had. Schramm was still, at that point, probably the most powerful individual in the National Football League. As powerful, if not more powerful, than the commissioner. Because actually, the commissioner, Pete Rozelle, he had hired in 1952, when Tex was the general manager of the L.A. Rams, he hired Rozelle as his publicist. So he had a long, long-standing relationship, unlike any owner, any general manager, with the commissioner of football. So it was the abruptness of the change. But look, I got to say, that was 1989. And by 1996, three Super Bowls in 4 years.
But then that was the last one, 96.
96, and after the 95 season. And that was done without Jimmy Johnson. Jimmy Johnson and Jerry Jones divorcing just basically dismantled whatever great organization had been built up. And I got 92 and 93 seasons, those two teams that went on to two consecutive Super Bowls, that was the best Cowboys team ever. I mean, talk about peak performance. Troy Aikman, Emmitt Smith, Michael Irvin, they were unstoppable. They were a juggernaut. They had a great defense. They were, on paper and by record, the best team in professional football. But at the very top, you have hubris, personalities, egos. I don't know. I still can't figure out whether it was Jimmy Johnson being so hot-headed and territorial, and he didn't like Jerry Jones meddling with his coaching decisions, or Jerry Jones feeling disrespected by his coach who kept barking about the owner doesn't really respect me. Whatever it was, this great relationship was broken up, and it's never been the same since. So there are two regimes we're talking about. That first regime had quite a run, and the second regime had a real brief, brilliant period that's been followed by no performance on the field, an average team, and yet remains in the conversation because Jerry Jones has exhibited his brilliance as an owner, by monetizing the team, finding revenue streams when no one else knew they existed. And as the NFL monetized, the Cowboys were right in front. They were actually leading the way. The one thing missing, the only ingredient missing is at the core of all this, if you look at this as a business now, which is what it is, and this is the most valuable sports franchise business in America, the one key ingredient missing is at the core, and that is you have a sports franchise. It helps to have a good team. So that's what makes this whole
story.
It
helps, but obviously it's not necessary.
It is necessary after a while. And as I look at the progression, we now have a franchise that's attached to the most fabulous, over-the-top sports spectator facility in existence.
Talk about that. You say the Statue of Liberty could fit inside the new stadium standing up.
Yeah. But, you know, it's almost transcended the fact that it's named after a football team. It's all these other events. And you go to a game there. And I was there last Monday night. Jerry Jones got my money. And I did not get a very good performance, although the cheerleaders in HD looked outstanding on that big screen. But it's like a theme park now. There's so much stuff going on. And, well, the art is outstanding. In fact, I talked to a gallery owner here in Dallas a couple weeks ago, and she said, you need to take the art tour. And she had been... This person had been inside of Jerry Jones' house early on in his ownership and said, it wasn't much like a lot of Leroy Neiman's. But Gene Jones and Jerry's daughter have done a bang-up job with art. And if you weren't going to a game, you would stop and ogle. But instead, you're trying to get to your seat or looking for the restroom.
Balancing two beers and a hot dog.
Yes, at $25.
Jonick Petoskey is with us. We're talking about his new book, The Dallas Cowboys, The Outrageous History of the Biggest, Loudest, Most Hated, Best Loved Football Team in America. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Author Jonick Petoskey is here. His new book is called The Dallas Cowboys, The Outrageous History of the Biggest, Loudest, Most Hated, Best Loved Football Team in America. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You know who comes off really good here?
Who?
The Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders.
It's hard to assail them. What can I say? They're America's sweethearts, but
they work hard to be America's sweethearts.
They work very, very hard, and to look at that, just see the physical perfection or the idealism or whatever. I just can't imagine how they maintain. How do they even walk around or do anything? Because when you see them perform, it's like it's high energy. It's no holds barred. And what's really weird to watch them at the stadium. Is interspersed between them now are these men wearing black, these security guys. They're just looking off into the zone. And it's such a weird juxtaposition because they are just life and action and energy. And then these other people looking over or looking out for them are just kind of furniture. But there have been other cheerleading organizations. The first were the Baltimore Colts cheerleaders, who the Baltimore Colts are the former – original Dallas Texans, and there was the Redskins had a band, but no one looked at these elements. And the Cowboys had cheerleaders through the 60s who were high school cheerleaders. What happened in the 70s is Tex basically looked at them and Tex sexed up their uniforms,
got rid of the guys,
and let's get out of high school, let's get young women. and let's apply a lot of dance routines. And that is why I spent one chapter early on in 67 talking about Bubbles Cash. Because I remember when Bubbles Cash, who is a stripper in Dallas, a very noted stripper, took a walk down the aisle of the Cotton Bowl in a mini dress bearing cotton candy and got not just the whole stadium looking at her, got both teams looking at her. And there was, and I'm sure it got Tex's attention because when 10 years after, Bubbles said that Tex sponsored a party celebrating the 10th anniversary. All of a sudden, all these strippers from other cities would come to games. They'd try to run out on the field and kiss players and things. And it started with Bubbles' walk. And I think that's where Tex, in his wisdom, brilliance, whatever, kind of did this. Yes, it's eye candy. But these girls look hard. Look, they work hard. They it was wholesome sex, wholesome TNA, I guess is what you'd call it. But you know that they really are. I mean, they were run. It was a very militaristic organization. They couldn't consort with players. They couldn't be around alcohol originally, and all these rules were really tough. And then Suzanne Mitchell did that one extra step and started using them with USO tours. And she makes the point, and I love that, where she said it was after the Cowboys had lost the Super Bowl, I think, in 78. That was sad, but, you know, right before then, her girls are at the demilitarized zone in Korea helping, you know, performing for soldiers, lonely soldiers. So there was a higher, better purpose. And they are America's sweethearts. But they're awfully sexed up for being sweethearts. That's all I know. And no offense to any of you all that are dancers. It's just that comes out of respect. And it's spectators, 3-1, 4-1 are male at the games. And so I figured that's why one reason why it's such a male spectator sport.
We have an email here from Jeff in Denton who wants to know if the role of family in the Jerry Jones franchise helps the business or hurts it.
Well, that's a good question because what it does is it is the future. And one thing that Jerry did and has done very effectively over the years was raise his children to basically take over this franchise. That's nothing new. The Mara family in the New York Giants, now the Kraft family, they're doing this multi-generationally. And that's the story here. It was 7 years before Jerry came in and upset the table and started over and was very effective. It's been 15 years, fallow years, since the Cowboys have been successful, but there's not going to be a new Jerry Jones coming in because he's not going to sell the team. He sees this as a very good business, and it is. It's no longer just a rich man's toy. And Stephen Jones is probably, it's a matter of time before he's already involved in much of the operations.
He's more reserved figure than his dad.
He is, and that's where my big question is, whenever the torch is passed, and it will be passed, I don't know if it'll
Jones
be this
is like
season.
70 this year, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Sometime it will be passed. And he could be owner emeritus or general manager emeritus. My hope is that Stephen Jones has the good sense to hire a general manager. Jerry was described to me by an oil man in Houston night before last that's done business with him. He said he's one of the smartest men he's ever known. He knows everything about everything. And I said, well, what was it like being on the other end of the negotiating table? He said, you don't want to be there. So that's the ultimate compliment. But the owner won't fire the general manager because the general manager is Jerry Jones. Mm-hmm. And this, to me, is the hang-up. This is a very complex sport, and I don't think any one person can do it. And he's almost setting himself up now to be like an old line owner, like Bud Adams, who's now still the owner of the Tennessee Titans, formerly the Houston Oilers. He meddles just enough to ruin that franchise. And I don't think Jerry is a meddler. He really is. He's knowledgeable in football, and is that he can't help himself. He will not yield to a football 24/7 person as general manager. And I think he needs good people around him, including his family, including his coach, and including his players. And I think his ownership would benefit with an outside football-specific general manager. That's my opinion.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Brandon on the line in Dallas. Hey, Brandon.
Howdy.
Howdy.
Howdy. I've never gotten a chance to get through the lines here before, but this is great because I've grown up with the Dallas Cowboys. I'm a native, and my family's property was just uphill from Texas Stadium. And, thinking all the way back from the days watching football and Roger Staubach and the boys doing their thing all the way into, you know, seeing Troy Aikman and Darryl Johnson and all them. And, and my sincere lament about the destruction of Texas Stadium, and still kind of mourning that to this day. So...
Were you sad to see it go, Jonick?
Yes and no. I mean, what was interesting is for all the hype on Cowboys Stadium, when Texas Stadium was built and opened in 1971, it was as radical, if not more so. It was a football-only facility, and all big stadiums being built at that time were multi-purpose, built for baseball and football, like the Astrodome. So seating was not very well. And in that respect, it was also built, the first modern stadium built for television. And I think it was privately financed. I mean, it was mainly Murchison's money. And it's a great story about Murchison, first one to get the Cotton Bowl refurbished, and the state fair committee wasn't interested.
And then he wanted downtown.
He wanted a downtown stadium. And this, to me, was fascinating that he even went so far he's offering an extra 10 acres for a museum of art. But J. Eric Johnson was the very urbane mayor of Dallas, and he was into this goals for Dallas. He had studied new urbanism. He wanted to create a new city. And, you know, he was from Brooklyn. He didn't sound like he was from Texas. He was the new global kind of Dallas guy who came out of TI. But he did not see in his urban vision a place for a football stadium downtown. And his reasoning was it would be empty most of the time. Well, you know, stadiums are used for many purposes today. And I'm totally against any kind of corporate welfare. I don't like this idea of having to – if someone wants to build a stadium, go build it. You can make all the money off of it. Good for you.
But no tax
revenue. I don't like tax money going to this kind of stuff. But on the other hand, I see the value of if that stadium would have been downtown, Texas Stadium or Cowboys Stadium, it would be a very different kind of dynamic in downtown Dallas. And it would probably add something seeing what baseball stadiums have done downtown. And to me, as fabulous as that stadium is, you walk outside that stadium and you're back in the 50s. It's all roads. There's no mass tran. Unless you get in your car, there's really nowhere to go. There's not a downtown right outside the stadium. So I think that's going to hurt future Super Bowls. Those big corporations coming in to spend money on parties don't like driving 30 miles. They liked that one in Indianapolis last year where it was right downtown. Everything was within 10 blocks of each other. And you don't have that. But I do think by the time it went down, Texas Stadium began to look like a strip mall, kind of a 70s era strip mall. It's like a little bit of the sidings seems like it's crumbling. It turned out to be a very hot place, not a pleasant place. I mean, originally it was going to be domed. That hole in the roof was going to be covered. Mm-hmm. They talked about air conditioning, then it wasn't. Then they lifted up the sides to be higher, so ventilation that was envisioned didn't happen. So there were a lot of downsides, but that stadium introduced the luxury suite to professional sports. The Astrodome had some, but not on this scale and not to where it became really dominating. And that made a big difference. And then the hole in the roof, you know, so God can watch his favorite team. Well, now in this new stadium, there's not a – the roof can open and close. But I love how everyone's always looking skyward at this higher power, including the players and the coaches. And that's the higher power is the big screen because it is the triumph of television in sports. And I'm here to tell you as an opinion, is not as someone that's gotten to – I have gotten to get seats near the field watching high school games at $10 a pop and $10 for parking. That's worth it. I'm not going to pay $500, $1,000 a seat. But that's what makes the new stadium very different. No matter where you're sitting, you're always looking up at the TV. It takes your eyes off the field. So this is a TV sport. And knowing what I know now, having watched games there and watched it on TV all my life, I think the TV version's better.
You know,
less commercials.
I can't remember if it was in the book itself or in something I was reading about the book where somebody was quoted as saying, I love the new stadium. It's just like I'm sitting at home watching the game on TV.
Yeah, I quoted a guy doing that, and I think, you know, and how much money did you pay for that privilege? it's kind of ridiculous and silly, but it's part of, you know, it's how all-encompassing sport is today and how important football is our lives.
Okay, so we just have a couple of minutes left. We've talked so much about the team and about its relationship to the city. And I'm not cutting you off. Don't worry. No. I have a question for you. But so if people really love the team, great for Dallas. If people really hate the team, is that bad for the city?
No, I think it's great because they have an image of the city. They're talking about Dallas. And that's this thread that's run through. I mean, early on, it was unintentional. It was like you had bad boys like Dwayne Thomas or Thomas Hollywood Henderson. They were as good as my favorite bad boy of all football, Joe Don Looney. But early on, you had that. It's just that before the NFL, today we talk about storylines. The Cowboys have always had storylines, and they've always had drama. And that's what makes them – they're a topic of conversation. And if the team's not very good, let's talk about the owner and his rap commercials or the fact that he's the best-known personality of the team, or let's talk about the stadium. There's plenty to talk about. But really and truly, you know, to keep this thing going and keep the conversation relevant, you really hope that the main product gets better than it is. And, you know, that's it's a different football team than what it was in the 60s and 70s. Definitely, it's a different game. But you know what? This is a different city. And in that respect, I liked drawing the conclusion that as we speak in the here and now, Dallas is landlocked. And it used to be this place of unlimited possibilities, unlimited growth. We've got suburbs ringing it now. And it's a lot more diverse than people will let on. I love that Valley Ranch, you can get great Indian, you can get great Thai, you can get great Central American cooking, all in Valley Ranch. And I thought that was, you know, kind of a controlled, gated community. There's a lot more going on here than meets the eye. And that's kind of, to me, after doing all this research, that's the real joy that I take away from this. This is a more interesting city than I started looking at.
The new book by Joenick Potoski is The Dallas Cowboys, The Outrageous History of the Biggest, Loudest, Most Hated, Best Loved Football Team in America. Joenick has a signing this evening. That's at the Barnes & Noble in Dallas, is that right?
At Lincoln Park.
Lincoln Park. All right, Joenick, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Jeff Whittington answered the phones today, and he is also senior producer of the show. Christine McConnell produces our podcast. You can get that podcast and find out about upcoming programs online at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.